Welcome to Her Story, a project by Chick History. I'm your host, Rebecca Price. For 1 year, we asked 50 contemporary women to share the story of the historical woman who has inspired her. Join us every week for a new story of inspiration, from the headliners to the lesser-known gems.
Dust off the books, read all the letters, preserve with time, dig out the truth written between. Her hair still brick, cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten.
Joining us today for Her Story number 48 is academic, museum professional, and artist, Dr. Tanya Matthews. Tanya holds degrees in engineering from Duke University and Johns Hopkins. She is also a nationally noted poet, storyteller, and spoken word artist with several Poetry Slam Awards and performs under the name Jaw Hipster. Currently, Tanya is Vice President of Museums at the Cincinnati Museum Center, where she oversees all education, research, and community outreach programs for the center. To learn more about Tanya and her work, you can visit her website, jawhipster.com, and follow her on Twitter at jawhipster. Tanya, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And which woman are you going to share with us today?
Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, please tell us all a little bit about Zora Neale Hurston.
Well, even though the name Zora Neale Hurston is a bit of a household name today, and in recent years she was thought of as a brilliant writer and anthropologist, even before Oprah Winfrey got her hands on Their Eyes Are Watching God, from the years preceding her death in 1960 to the early 1970s, Zora Neale Hurston had drifted off into obscurity. She was buried in a pauper's field with no headstone. Now, as I tell her story, I'm going to do what I normally might consider offensive, which is to refer to a great scholar by her first name. But there is something so quintessential about Zora Neale Hurston that her first name is as much an adjective as Google is a verb. So you'll have to excuse my cheekiness because I know that Zora would appreciate it. She was born in January 1891 in Nottasalga, Alabama, the fifth of eight children. When she was still a very young child, her father moved the family to Eatonville, Florida, which was the oldest incorporated black town in America. And even though this was the South, the Deep South, Zora's childhood was not one of Jim Crow, because this town, like many black towns of that day, had a tacit understanding with its surrounding white communities. That is to say, don't start none, won't be none, and everyone left everyone else alone. So Zora was surrounded by black teachers, black doctors, black shop owners, black mayors, et cetera, et cetera. Now, this isn't to be confused with a middle-class existence, because these folks were country and poor, as near to poverty as you could get without actually starving to death. But there is a particular richness in self-determination, so Zora had a happy, dream-filled, and encouraging childhood until her mother died. And her father remarried a young woman only 3 years older than Zora, and actually 3 years younger than Zora's oldest sister. This, for many reasons, did not work. And in 1917, at the age of 26, Zora moved to Baltimore with the intent of going to high school. Now, at 26, she was too old to get a free high school education, so she lied about her age, became 16 on the day of her enrollment, and never looked back, literally. And this began her now legendary, fiercely self-deterministic and individualistic streak that delights and irks Hurstonites all over the world to this day. Her willingness, rather her absolute deliberateness, to tell her story the way she thought it best be told. Even in her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Dirt Road, she keeps 1901 as her birth date. Similarly, her birthplace became Eatonville, Florida, rather than Alabama, because she preferred it. She finished high school in a year. Then she went on to Howard University to begin her college studies and later won a scholarship to Barnard College in New York. Through all of this is when Zola's career as a writer and anthropologist began. She was first published in Howard University's Literary Magazine in 1921, and in 1925, she won two prizes in two different writing categories in a literary journal called Opportunity. And this launched her into the national spotlight of African-American writers to be reckoned with. That very same year, she started at Barnard and met a renowned anthropologist, Frank Boas, who then became her mentor and a major influence in Zora's life and professional career as an anthropologist. Zora was what we would call an unabashed black culturalist. And from the late 1920s through the 1940s, she traveled to African-American and African diaspora communities to document the lives and stories of black peoples. Her travels included communities from Haiti and the Honduras to Harlem and Eatonville. The image of these travels, at first glance, is quite glamorous, because of course we have them in Zora's own words. A stylish woman in a late model car driving through hidden cultural enclaves with a camera, a recorder, and a shotgun in the passenger seat, collecting the stories of these amazing people. But in truth, it was really hard and sometimes dangerous work, suffering through heat and gnats, mosquitoes, snakes, sleeping in her car, dodging Ku Klux Klan country, and whatever other dangers awaited a single woman traveling alone during that time. And even though she had both technique and color on her side, getting the stories from the people was never that easy. In her seminal collection of folklore from the Deep South of Mules and Men, she writes about this. She says, "Folklore is not as easy to collect as it sounds. And the Negro, in spite of his open-faced laughter, his seeming acquiescence, is particularly evasive. You see, we are a polite people, and we do not say to our questioner, 'Get out of here.' We smile and tell him or her something that satisfies the person because, knowing so little about us, he doesn't know what he's missing. The Indian resists curiosity by a stony silence. The Negro offers a feather bed of resistance." During this time, Zora lived many simultaneous writing lives. In addition to being an anthropologist, she was a novelist, playwright, and essayist. Her works appeared everywhere, from the Saturday Post, and some of her plays actually premiered on Broadway. She was one of the original driving forces of the Harlem Renaissance in the late 1920s, early 1930s, along with good friends of hers like County Cullen and Langston Hughes. At one point, all three of them lived in the same boarding house and had some of the same benefactors. Zora had a magnificent command of language, which she used to gently but unmistakably drive home the existence and mind of a, quote, Negro woman of her day. And I love the way she talks. So from quotes like, "Sometimes I feel discriminated against, but it does not make me angry. It is simply beyond me how anyone could deny themselves the pleasure of my company." To other more political quotes, such as, "I am not tragically colored. There is no great sorrow dammed up in my soul nor lurking behind my eyes. I do not mind at all. I do not weep at the world. I am too busy sharpening my oyster knife." This is the woman who told her great mentor, the revered anthropologist, that white people could not be trusted to accurately collect black folklore. This is also the woman who snuck copies of forbidden manuscripts to prestigious black colleagues against the wishes of the white funders and benefactors of those manuscripts. This is the woman who published 8 books, a dozen plays, and countless essays, all presented in the most prominent circles. So you have to wonder, how did she end up buried in a pauper's field, alone, uncelebrated, impoverished, and in obscurity? And so here's the question her life brings to me, which is, would you sacrifice the credit you are due just to live on your own terms? Because indeed, Zora was a black culturalist, a bit of a nationalist too, in retrospect, but that was not all she was, and her views just did not conform to the storyline of the movement surrounding her, white or black. So this was also the woman who stated that slavery was simply the price she had to pay for civilization, and she had no qualms with that. This is also the woman who went from friend to enemy of Langston Hughes because they were fighting over rights to a play that they had written together. This is a woman who lied about her origins, her life, and her faults as she saw fit, even in Ten as an autobiography. And while common folk and white audiences acclaimed Their Eyes Were Watching God, the black intelligentsia and the stalwarts of the Harlem Renaissance absolutely slammed it for its, quote, shameful use of country vernacular and feeding into American stereotypes of poor, dumb country Negroes. This is the woman who publicly opposed the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision and decried the integration of schools. Zora had style, but she was determined to leave all of the sugarcoating for those who had time for it. Likely, it wasn't just that she was black and loud, it was that she was female, black and loud, and unapologetic to boot. If you think about the names of writers and thinkers of the Harlem Renaissance and of this era, you think of men. Maybe there was no room for such an absolutely out-of-order set of ideas from a woman. And by challenging normal white conventions and leaving little room for an easy black defense, she may have cut ties to her strongest allies. It was none other than the venerable, prize-winning godfather of African-American literature, the author of Native Son, Richard Wright, who led the charge against Their Eyes Were Watching God. And while she was severely wounded by these attacks, she refused to cower. In a letter that she wrote to her still friend, County Cullen, she says, "I have the nerve to walk my own way, however hard, in my search for reality, rather than climb upon the rattling wagon of wishful illusions." And thus, she wrote her own story. Into her waning years at a welfare home in an unmarked grave at the age of 69, though she would still tell you she was only 59, in 1960. And nearly 15 years later, another groundbreaking and fairly unapologetic female African-American writer, the authoress of The Color Purple, Miss Alice Walker, would rediscover Zora Neale Hurston via her own personal journey. She dedicated herself to wrestling Zora's memories from obscurity. So in 1973, it was Alice Walker who found Zora Neale Hurston's gravesite and bought and installed a tombstone. It stands there to this day, and it reads, "Zora Neale Hurston, a genius of the South."
And why did you pick Zora as your inspirational woman in history?
You know, because she was so herself. It takes so much courage, I think, to do what she was doing, and it's hard to tell whether or not she was really aware of the fact that some of the decisions that she was making were going to actually cost her the credit that she was due. But she was clearly aware of friendships lost. She had to suffer through criticisms from people that she both loved and respected. But that she had this need to be her own self. And I appreciate her love and reverence of African-American culture, and I'm a fan of folklore, and I'm also a writer, so her words are also amazing. And I think the funny thing about it is that even if I was there in that time, I would have admired her for the way she wrote and what she said, but I don't think that we would have gotten along. It's so funny. I think that some of her politics would have struck me the way that they struck people of her time, and she really didn't seem to leave room in her inner circle for people who disagreed with her about certain things. So I don't think that I would have been allowed in her inner circle, and probably two strong women on the opposite sides of that corner would have hated each other, but it would have been one of those love-hate kind of things, because you've just got to appreciate the fact that she would always speak her mind and speak it in a beautiful way that people still wanted to listen to, even if they refused to agree with it.
And what about a book? Do you have something that you would recommend so listeners can start learning more about her?
So I'm going to cheat a little, and I'm going to assume that if you're listening to Chick History, you have already read Their Eyes Were Watching God, so I can take that off the list. So I would actually say read her essay, How It Feels to Be Colored Me, which you can find on the Internet. It'll take you a few minutes. This was the one that set off the firestorm of controversy. And then combine that with reading of Mules and Men, which is her collection of folklore, but it also talks about her process in getting it and what she was seeing at the time. So that combination, I think, will really give you insight into really the power of her language and the way she said things, which is really second to none.
Well, there you have it for Zora Neale Hurston. Tanya, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
You're welcome.
To learn more about her story and other projects by Chick History, you can visit the website chickhistory.com. And please join us every week for another story of an inspirational woman in history.
I'm here to tell a story. Something precious and fine about a woman who made a difference with her life. She might not be known, but to only a few, her story remembered here is gonna change that view. She shall not be forgotten. Her story not forgotten.